Prologue. Driving. August 1999. My father, steady at 55 miles per hour behind the wheel of the Buick station wagon, always flashed his headlights to let the truckers know it was safe to pass at night. And they would blink their taillights in acknowledgement. A secret handshake between the professional big riggers and my father. Driving in the black gloom of an oncoming storm, I clicked the lights of my Honda CRV as a Walmart rig roared past me on the big hill that curves down and out of the Central Valley. The 18-wheeler switched on and off his running lights that encircled his cab and flatbed. I smiled a little, wishing someone had come with me if for no other reason than to show them that my dad was right. I would turn 32 years old in 3 months, but I had long ago absorbed his either careful or neurotic tendencies, depending on one's perspective on following the rules. As the rain started to fall, I ticked off the same roadside markers he pointed out on every family trip. A small white shield every tenth of a mile, followed by a tall green one every mile. I was driving the New York State Thruway the hour and a half due north to our family house in the 50s-era suburbs of the city of Kingston. The foothills of the headlands, as my sister called them, were sandwiched between the Hudson River and the wall of the Catskill Mountains. Which aren't really mountains, Dad had often told me, but a tree-covered plateau eroded by rivers seeking the sea. The late summer storm passed quickly, and when I reached the Plattekill Rest Area, mile marker 65, the sun had returned, igniting the wet road into mist. I divided my speed, undad-like 80, by the number of miles until mile marker number 92, home. I repeated the calculation with every signpost. Plenty of time to wonder why the government spent so much to neatly mow the median and what I would find at home when I got there. The place that aside from family vacations I had spent not a single night away from until I went to college. Oh, that wasn't entirely true, I remembered, as I turned off the highway and merged onto Kingston's lone traffic circle. I had once convinced them to let me go to the state chess tournament in Syracuse, my last year of high school. But, according to my father, I had come back so unruly he would never permit it again. The house, a cross between a ranch and a salt box draped in white aluminum siding, on a quiet dead-end street, looked as unassuming as always. But the lawn on our quarter-acre plot was a disaster. A decade of neglect. Dandelions had beaten back everything except the duck grass that stayed brown most of the year, and my father had never been able to defeat. I sat in the car for a moment. The bottom panel of the screen door was as busted as the day I had kicked it in. Clear evidence that everything would be as I left it on my last visit, nearly 3 months ago. Upstairs, my bedroom would be dark with maybe a water glass that had evaporated down to a thin coat of dust. The closet would be stuffed with my unfinished elementary school art products. Old copies of Byte magazine, and that dubious peach-colored award for last place in the National Programming Contest in Atlanta, 1988. My father didn't come to greet me, but I imagined him in the driveway, the hood of one Buick or another up as he respaced the spark plugs or degummed the carburetor's butterfly valve, extending the life of the car another 100,000 miles. He was an engineer by training and desire, and I remembered him surrounded by parts, the lawnmower blade he resharpened every season, the innards of the kitchen clock that kept breaking, or spiced ham for the sandwiches we assembled as a family on Saturdays. We sat in the spotless living room, me in the blue chair that I sat in for his lectures, and my father, with his thin legs bent Indian style beneath him, on the green shag carpet. His shoes were off, exposing deformed toes that had become crumpled in shoes handed down through four elder brothers. I saw his bald spot. He combed his gray hair over. The thick white mustache he'd always had. The beard that was starting to grow unchecked after 9 years of retirement. The thick photo-gray glasses as wide as a windshield. And the nose, like mine, a honker. Everything was right except a small glass of Old Smuggler whiskey resting next to his ashtray. There had always been the one regular drink after work, and I would never have guessed that such a minor pleasure, a tiny blue dot of ink bled into the breast pocket of the crisp, white shirt portrait of a man defined by obligation, responsibility, and dedication to his family, would overtake him so completely. His concern for me having been replaced by worries that he would run out of whiskey. I looked at the couch no one had sat on since my mother died 2 years earlier. My father's health aide had folded her old blanket on one of the gray cushions. Dad's acceleration beyond the one-a-day drink had begun with her Alzheimer's. As her sole caretaker during those years, he'd ramped up slowly but steadily until by 1999 he was downing a pint of whiskey a day. My business partner, Dan, the same generation as my father, said the drinking was simply his cure for the sadness that had become his disease. Dan, at my request, had traveled to the house a year before. He took a rare day away from work and his family to come 3 hours by train and another two by car to spend an afternoon with my father, arguing sincerely with him on the front stoop to stop drinking. To become the old dad, the one who taught me to hang my shirt's buttons facing left. The afternoon had stretched into a 24-hour ordeal that in the end hadn't changed anything, except for me to put that hole in a screen door and push my father a little further into his seclusion. The next morning, driving back to New York to get Dan to the train, he'd rested a hand silently on my shoulder. I knew Dan cared about me as much as anyone now. That's why I had come back. To get the father my money had offered to me in earlier, soberer days. $200,000 in IBM stock that he had acquired, sometimes a fraction of a share at a time, over all those years. But looking at him on the floor, surrounded by plastic bags full of cigarette butts, junk mail, and bits of his broken nails that he'd plucked from his toes, I felt less certain. "How is old Dan?" my father asked. I looked at the picture of myself on the mantel, a computer printout made of dot matrix letters arranged to show my Dorothy Hamill bowl cut and my own photo gray glasses. "Still calling himself a benevolent capitalist?" he continued. He'd kept that photo on his mid-level engineer's metal desk at IBM. In his world, there was no greater god than the old IBM, and it was the same for me. Next to the family Bible on the shelf below my portrait was the familiar black and gold binding of Think, the biography of Thomas Watson, and the thin blue spine of the IBM ethics manual. My father was a firm adherent of the meritocracy those books espoused. For him, advancement in the world was assured via IBM's twin path to promotion, one for managers who liked to, quote, play politics, and one for engineers who were promoted solely on their intelligence and objective accomplishments. When I was 7, playing a game of war with maple branches as rifles, I had proudly told a defeated enemy, "You aren't out. IBM puts you on probation for 6 months, so you can improve your performance." Respect for the individual. I believed it then. I still believed it. "He says you love me," I said, unexpectedly, and maybe a little too angry. But my father's face showed no shock. He had retired in disgust when Big Blue had their first ever layoff. He had been promised a promotion to senior engineer, but his boss of 2 decades reneged on the deal, knowing my father would resign. It gave the boss a needed chit in the drive to let go of 20% of the employees. After that, Dad had started going to Atlantic City. He started fighting more with Mom, and one terrible night, he'd packed a bag and spent the night at the Super 8, frustrated that his life's work of responsibility had netted him only resentment. And I begin to sense that I didn't know what the man I wanted, more than anything to be, had wanted his life to become. His anger from that night never went away, and when he chose to take care of Mom's declining health, he didn't speak directly about it. Instead, he scolded us loudly, using his "I'm counting to three" voice that said, "Visiting home isn't about coming here to have fun and go out with your friends. You need to look after your mother." But after she died, the anger still emerged, and when he saw ads for Microsoft, Bill Gates, of course, had betrayed IBM, or he was reminded about the doctor who had first diagnosed Mom with Alzheimer's, he scared her, and she never recovered from that. But for the most of the time, it lied dormant, deep within, covered by a thick carpet of scotch. "Of course I do," he said. "You're my son." He leaned to blow smoke into the chimney the way Mom had made him, keep the smell out of the house, and continued, "Now tell me about that Clarinda." "Typesetting," I said, and he watched me intently, the glass by his side untouched. "The process of putting bits of lead together to make pages is long dead, but the opportunity..." I felt the words coming like they did when I was trying to impress my father about having gotten on the dean's list, a torrent of self-created conviction. "The opportunity to make pages for publishers using computers continues to grow, and editorial services, copy editing, indexing, design..." He was getting distracted, looking beyond me, and I, nervous, switched directions. "You're getting it on the ground floor of the roll-up of the American typesetting industry. First we buy Clarinda, the premier typesetting company in Clarinda, Iowa. They've been in business for almost 50 years, and Dan negotiated with the bank that owns them to sell to us for almost nothing. He smiled and puffed again. My son, Mr. Businessman. All we need is $200,000, I said, the words coming out of my mouth while my mind tried to absolve me of doubt. All his savings. All his bad weather savings, for just in case. If I lost it, who would take care of him? He laughed and patted his pockets. Not here. But you're welcome to whatever I've got. You know that. Are you sure? I asked. He grinned and took a sip of whiskey. You'll pay it back, he said, his yellow teeth showing. I know you. Of course, I said. I had to. So if you're going in the kitchen, how about you get me another ice cube? And while you're in there, he said, and smiled, like a child expecting another grilled cheese sandwich, why don't you top off my glass?